This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
You know, the presidential campaign at the moment has of course, a number of controversial issues, but some of the most contentious involve Islam, whether the topic is terrorism, immigration, or U.S. policies in the Middle East. Shadi Hamid's new book comes at a very opportune moment. The book, Islamic Exceptionalism, looks at the role of religion in politics under Islam and how the struggle to resolve this problematic church state, or I should say mosque state, relationship continues to have profound implications for the Middle East and the rest of the world. Shadi is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and has taken a particular interest in the study of Islamic movements. After attending Georgetown University, he earned a doctorate in political science at Oxford, then started researching Islamist movements about a dozen years ago when he was living in Amman. He's immersed himself in the world of these movements, probing what animates them, examining what they really want. His first book on political Islam 2 years ago, Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East, explored how Islamist movements have tended to evolve over time. In his new book, he develops the premise that Islam is unique among religions for its political goals. He traces Islam's governmental role from the pre-modern era to the advent of the ruthless Islamic state. And he examines various models or approaches that Islamist movements are trying to apply in order to work through the challenge of Islam's relationship to political orders. This book has relevance not only for the political debate underway here in this country, but also for our understanding of events unfolding in the Middle East. As Shadi says in his prologue, many of those who call the Middle East home are rethinking their own assumptions these days. A review in Kirkus called the book, a review in Kirkus said the book provides, quote, fresh, provocative thinking. The Washington Post called the book illuminating. And Publishers Weekly said the work, quote, offers tentative hopes for those seeking a new way through the intricacies of Islamic politics in the Middle East. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Shadi Hamid.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Is this working? Hello? Yeah, great. Okay. Yes. Thank you so much for the introduction. Thank you to Politics and Prose for having me. It's a pleasure and honor to be here. I'm also flattered that many of you decided to come on a Friday night to talk about religion and politics. So I appreciate that and glad to see that so many of you are interested in the topic. So I guess I would just start off by saying, you know, this in some ways is a very personal book for me. I've lived about six of the last 12 years of my life in the Middle East, and the Middle East has a way of changing you. Some of my friends and family tell me that I've become more pessimistic over time, and that's probably true. I have been changed as a result of the events that I try to document in this book. I was in the Middle East at the peak of optimism, when we believed things would be better. All of you remember when the strong man of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, fell to mass protests. I was there in Tahrir Square on February 11th, 2011. And kind of when I look back, it makes me a little bit sad because that moment for me has become blurry because so many bad things have happened since. So that's, you know, part of what we'll talk about is how did that really happen, and kind of looking at it more from a broad historical perspective. And I'll try my best to capture pretty much 14 centuries since the founding of Islam until the present day as best as I can in 20, 25 minutes or so. So in addition to becoming more pessimistic, I've also really come to appreciate more and more the role and power of religion in the Middle East. And part of what I've done is spend a lot of time with Islamist movements. And the groups that I've spent more time with are what we would call mainstream Islamist movements. So groups like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the Nahda in Tunisia, the AK Party in Turkey. And I should just say that those groups are quite different than Islamist movements on the far extreme right, like ISIS, that use violence and terror to pursue their aims. In contrast, groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, whatever else we might think about them, they accept the nation state to some extent. They participate in parliamentary politics and so on. So those are the groups that I've spent a lot of time with. And one thing that's really struck me when you talk to a kind of ordinary Muslim Brotherhood member, they don't really separate in their own minds between religion and politics. So when you spend, really, in my case, hundreds of hours interviewing some of these people, it's hard to know where politics ends and religion begins. Or to put it another way, where religion ends and politics begins, they're just kind of endlessly intertwined. And I think for those of us who come from a Western secular background, it can sometimes be hard to really appreciate or relate to the everyday magic of religion for people who really believe. So I think we as outsiders have to make an extra effort and kind of make a leap of faith, if you will, to understand that power and that magic, even if we ourselves may not be totally comfortable with it. And so when I talk about the power of religion, let me just share one anecdote that maybe captures this a little bit. I remember, so when we try to understand why people join a group like the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, we think about maybe they're poor, maybe they're unemployed and they're looking for meaning or belonging, or maybe they're interested in political power and they're using religion. We find all these non-religious explanations to explain why people join a religious organization. And all of those factors, of course, do play a role, economics and the desire for power and so on. But I remember I had a conversation with a mid-level Muslim Brotherhood official, and we were talking about, because every Brotherhood member kind of has a conversion story of how they joined the movement, right? And he said, Shadi, you know, sometimes it's a lot more simple than all those other factors. Sometimes people join the Muslim Brotherhood because they want to get into heaven. And I thought this was a very interesting way of putting it. And it might sound irrational to the Western ear. Oh, this is, come on, really? But if you look at it another way, what could be more rational than wanting eternal paradise? Right? If that's what you believe, if that's your starting assumption, and you believe in heaven and all of that, the day of judgment and so on, then that's for the rest of eternity. And the idea is if you join a group like the Muslim Brotherhood, that will help you become a better Muslim. And if you become a better Muslim, then you'll have a better chance on the Day of Judgment with the scales and all of that. So that I think is – that forces us in a way to challenge our assumptions of why ultimately people do what they do. And so this book in a way is an attempt to situate the role of religion. So when we're looking at the demise of the Arab Spring, the rise of ISIS, all the civil wars that are going on, the question that I've gotten really for the last couple years is, how much does Islam matter? Is this about religion? And how much, if it is about religion, how do we understand that? So that's part of what I'll try to address today. So the one of the main arguments I make, and I guess the most controversial argument I make in the book, is that Islam is in fact exceptional. Now, what does that really mean? Because in a way, all religions are unique, but they're not all unique in the same way. So my argument here is that Islam is exceptional specifically in how it relates to law, politics, and governance. So in both theory and practice, Islam has proven to be resistant to secularization. And I would argue, for the foreseeable future, for the rest of our lives, Islam will continue to be resistant to secularization. But I am slightly uncomfortable with some of my own conclusions in this book, because I'm very well aware that anti-Muslim bigots could misuse or misconstrue some of my arguments for purposes that I don't agree with. I don't think we should ban Muslims from the U.S., things like that, right? And this is a climate where I'm very sensitive to the fact that, you know, the way we talk about Islam and Muslims, I think, in our country, unfortunately, has become more and more problematic. So I want to be very clear about my argument from the outset so people don't get the wrong idea. So for me, Islamic exceptionalism is neither good nor bad. It can be bad in some ways, and it can be good in other ways. And that's why we have to look at each particular country or context and look at the nuances and how it differs from case to case. If Islam does play an outsized role, it's going to play a different outsized role in Malaysia than it does in Jordan or than it does in Morocco. So the local context really matters when we're trying to understand how Islam manifests itself in everyday life. Now, why would Islam be exceptional? What are the sources of this exceptionalism? Now, there are a number of different factors, that I look at in the book, and that's why you should read the book and buy the book if you really want to know what all of them are. So I'll just mention a couple fairly quickly here that I think are perhaps the more interesting and the more controversial, which will hopefully spur some discussion. So my starting point, I have to go back 14. This is where I go back 14 centuries. And as you know, Islam started in the 7th century in Arabia. So it might be banal to say so, but history matters and founding moments matter. And the founding moment of Islam, I think, is very important to look at more closely. And I would say the founding moment still matters 14 centuries later as we're having this conversation today. So Jesus, as you know, was a dissident against a reigning state. So when we're looking at it comparatively, there's a reason that the New Testament doesn't have a lot to say about law or governance, because Jesus was never in a position to govern. So naturally, that's not what the New Testament would focus on. On the other hand, Prophet Muhammad was not just a prophet. He was a politician. Not only was he a politician, he was a head of state. Not only was he a head of state, he was a state builder. Those are important things. So in that sense, the religious and political functions are intertwined in the person of Prophet Muhammad. It wasn't an accident of history. That's the way it was supposed to be. Prophet Muhammad was meant to have those different functions kind of combined in one. Now, for the believer, so if you're a Muslim believer, you would say that it couldn't have been otherwise. This was part of God's plan for Prophet Muhammad to be both a prophet and a politician. He captured and held territory, and then he governed that territory. So that's one way of looking at it. It was God's plan. If we're kind of taking a step back and trying to look at it as outside observers from an analytical standpoint, you could say that this was part of how history evolved. And you can imagine an alternative history where, let's say, Prophet Muhammad lost some of those early battles and he wasn't able to capture or hold territory. Then he wouldn't have been able to govern territory. And then presumably in my counterfactual alternative parallel universe, the Quran wouldn't have had much to say or anything to say about law or governance, because Prophet Muhammad wouldn't have been in a position to govern. This also affects how we talk about violence. So I get this question a lot. Is the Quran violent? Is Islam violent? That sort of thing. And sometimes I get exhausted answering those questions. But let me just say something very quickly on that. Historically, at least in the pre-modern era, if you want to build a state, you have to capture territory first, as I've mentioned. And, you know, usually people aren't going to be nice to you and be like, hey, do you want some territory to start your own state? So the only way to start your own state is to wrest control of territory from other people. How do you do that? Through violence, although maybe violence isn't the best word because of its pejorative connotation. But let's say at least you have to engage in battle. You have to engage in warfare. So yes, in the Quran, there are verses that have to do with battle and warfare. But again, I would argue that is because how could it have been otherwise, really? Because if Prophet Muhammad was engaging in battle, then presumably God would have to say something to him about how you engage in battle. So that's another way of looking at it. So that's one factor, that the founding moment matters. And Muslims today, at least in theory, are supposed to emulate the Prophet's example. There's a kind of admiration or love, and people care what the Prophet did 14 centuries ago. So how might this have implications 14 centuries later? Well, if you are a secular Muslim reformer, and I should be very clear here, there have been many Muslim reformers who have argued for maybe not full-on secularism, but for at least some separation of religion from politics, of kind of reinterpreting certain things in that light, and trying to make religion at least a little bit more of a private thing than being an all-encompassing political project. The problem is these Muslim secular reformers, they haven't gained a lot of traction in the Middle East and beyond. Why? Because they essentially, if you're arguing for secularism, you have to argue in a way against the prophetic model. Because any Muslim, even if they don't kind of read that much the Quran or Sharia or other kind of religious sources, they know intuitively just by kind of absorbing it or going to Sunday school, at least in this country, Muslims do go to Sunday school too. So that you would know that Prophet Muhammad did play a political role. So if you're a secular reformer today in a country like Egypt or Jordan or Malaysia for that matter, you would essentially have to argue against the prophetic model, or you would have to explain it away, kind of put it to the side. You can do that, but it's difficult and it kind of involves complex hermeneutical techniques. You really have to dive into Islamic law and make complex arguments. For a lot of Muslims, they want their religion to be easy and straightforward. And I remember there have been times just experimentally I've tried to make the case for reinterpreting certain aspects of the Quran or the Hadith to a cab driver in Egypt, just for fun, whatever. And you realize that it's not a very easy case to make. You sort of have to – it's not easy. So you have to spend like 10 or 15 minutes, and then the cab driver is just kind of like zoning out. He's like, hey, man, I want my religion to be simple. So that maybe that kind of conveys it a little bit. So that makes it, I think, challenging for people who want secularism to really gain mass support in Muslim-majority countries. The second factor I'll mention – a source of Islamic exceptionalism, if you will, is how Muslims view scripture, and in particular the Quran. Now, this is a little bit complex, so I'll try to do the brief version. So for this book, I had to dive a little bit into Christian theology. So the second chapter is a kind of comparative historical study of the evolution of Christianity compared to the evolution of Islam over the centuries. So for those of you who are really into Christian theology, I think you'll like that chapter. But I'm sure there's a couple of you who are into Christian theology here, right? But one of the creedal requirements of Islam is that you're supposed to believe that the Quran is not just the Word of God. It's not only the Word of God. It's something more than that. It's also God's actual speech. And this might sound like a semantic distinction, but so for example, if you talk to far-right Christian evangelicals here in the U.S., they will say that they believe that the Bible is the Word of God, but they don't believe that it's God's actual speech. In other words, They will acknowledge that there is some human role or human authorship, that there were different authors for different books of the Bible. Now, they will say that the Bible is free from falsehood, that God, in a sense, protected the integrity of the text. But still, there was a role for men to play. In Islam, on the other hand, when we talk about Quranic inerrancy compared to biblical inerrancy, Muslims would say that every single letter and word is directly from God. Prophet Muhammad played no role whatsoever. He didn't do any writing. He didn't do any kind of – he didn't interfere with what God had revealed to him through the angel Gabriel. That is actually, in my view, a big difference, and one I don't think we talk about so often, because I think it's hard to really it's hard to relate to that. If that might I don't know, maybe that sounds weird to some people, this idea that as a creedal requirement, Muslims believe that this is God's actual speech. So that does presumably have implications for how you engage with the text. It doesn't mean that you can't reinterpret. It doesn't mean that there is a wide diversity of interpretations, because even if you're taking the Quran and you're like, so you take five Muslims, they all agree that this is God's exact word. That doesn't mean they all agree what it means. There's still the issue of context. There's still an issue of what did God really mean when he revealed this to Prophet Muhammad. But the point still remains that you're dealing with God's actual speech. That's important. Okay, so if you and I should also say, Muslims, just as sometimes Christians misunderstand how Muslims view the Quran, I think Muslims misunderstand how Christians view the Bible. And they make this mistake and they say, well, oh, look, the Bible, that's just written by men. That's not really from God. And that's part of the whole tradition of Islamic apologetics and kind of not taking Christianity seriously. But I think one of the misunderstandings, Muslims misunderstand that the equivalent of the Quran in Christianity is not a book, but a man. Jesus is the Word made flesh. So I think that's a really important distinction, that it's more about Jesus than the specifics of the New Testament in terms of the founding aspects of Christianity, so on and so forth. Anyway, okay, so if you accept my premise that Islam is exceptional, the question is, how does that really matter today as we're talking now in the 21st century? So when we try to understand the rise of ISIS or the demise of the Arab Spring, we talk a lot about 2011. So I mentioned the start of the Arab Spring, right? We also talk about 2003, the Iraq invasion. And those two dates, no doubt, are very important. But I think sometimes we look at things very narrowly, and there's history. History didn't start in 2003. Presumably something was happening before that. And a date that's really important for me that I discuss in the book is 1924. And all of you are probably nodding your heads, yeah, 1924. Okay, never mind. But so 1924, something very important happened. It marks the formal abolition of the last caliphate, the Ottoman caliphate. And it's kind of striking to think that that's actually pretty recent. That was less than a century ago. So we're not dealing with ancient history here. We're dealing really with events that were quite consequential that happened in the 20th century. So I would argue and posit to you today that ever since then, there's been a struggle to establish a legitimate political order in the Middle East. And at the center of that struggle are a set of unresolved questions over the role of religion in public life, over Islam's relationship to the state, or the state's relationship to Islam. And unfortunately, almost 100 years later, these fundamental foundational questions remain unresolved. Why? Well, part of the problem here is that pre-modern Islamic law wasn't designed for the modern era. It wasn't designed for an era of modern nation states. So that becomes a very tough question for modern day, whether you're Islamist, secular, or something in between. How do you take something that was designed for the pre-modern era and was revealed in 7th century Arabia and make it relevant, meaningful, and applicable 14 centuries later? That is difficult. And how do you square that circle? And I would argue that there isn't really a way to square the circle. And that's part of the problem. No one really knows exactly how to do it. And in this sense, some of the groups that I look at in the book, I also look at ISIS, but for a moment, I'll just say something about mainstream Islamist movements. So again, groups like the Muslim Brotherhood at Nahda in Tunisia, they participate in the electoral process. They're mostly nonviolent and so on. So these mainstream Islamist groups, if I had to define mainstream Islamism in a sentence, I would describe it as the attempt to reconcile pre-modern Islamic law with the modern nation state. So in this sense, Islamist movements don't necessarily harken back to the 7th century. They're quite modern in many ways. And if we had been having this conversation 4 centuries ago, none of us would use the word Islamist or the word Islamism. Islamist did not exist in the pre-modern era. Why? Because Islam imbued every aspect of public life. It went without saying. It was the natural order of things. So if it went without saying, it didn't need to be said. No one had to affirm their identity and say, "I am Islamist." Why? Why would you need to do that? So you had an overarching religious, legal, and moral culture that imbued everything to one degree, you know, to one degree or another. But in the modern era, for the first time, you have these new ideologies and ideas coming from the West, secularism, socialism, nationalism, and so on. So for the first time, people feel a need to affirm their Islamic identity in opposition to something else. So all these secular ideas are coming in. So Islamists, in quotation marks, say, we have to make Islam into a distinct political project. And in that sense, Islamism is something new and really unprecedented. So I guess the way to see it then is that Islamism, in a way, is inherently polarizing because it depends on its opposite. You can't have Islamists without having secularists. If secularists disappeared and everyone was kind of cool with Islam playing a role in public life, then that would be it. But that's not what we have now. We have these primary fundamental divides between Islamists on one hand and non-Islamists on the others and on the other. And that can include liberals, secularists, leftists, socialists, you name it. So what they're really debating here and what people are fighting over in any number of countries today are these raw existential issues over the meaning and nature of the nation state. So it's not, people aren't debating policy. They're debating something that's almost metaphysical in a way, about how you relate to the state and how people relate to their own religion is a very personal thing. So people get very aroused on those issues, and that makes violence more likely because you're trying to resolve essentially metaphysical issues. Now, as I close here, let me try to end on I'll kind of give a little say something about what might be a way forward. Is there anything to be particularly optimistic about? Okay. So I think that one thing that I'm trying to challenge in this book is that all cultures, peoples, and societies follow this linear trajectory. Reformation, enlightenment, secularism, towards the end of history of liberal democracy. Christianity followed a certain trajectory. And I think too often we superimpose that history and say, oh, Islam is going to follow the same course, or Islam should follow the same course. But Islam is a completely different religion. So we have to question that starting assumption about whether or not Islam will go through a reformation. I think hopes for a reformation are misplaced. And I think we have to deal with the Middle East not as we wish it to be, but as it actually is. And I think there's also something patronizing a little bit when people say, hey, you Muslims, you know, I know it's hard. You know, you're going through a lot of violence and all that. But don't worry. We Christians went through that. We had hundreds of years of religious wars. We had a Reformation, and that was tough. But we got through it, and now we're all liberal, secular, and nice. You'll get there in your own time. Don't worry. I mean, it's kind of patronizing, right? And I think it reflects an inability or unwillingness to really acknowledge difference. Why aren't we willing to entertain the notion that there are other cultures or religions that might follow a different path than the one the Christian West followed? So I think part of this is about coming to terms with this reality that Islam will play a prominent role in public life. Again, that's not always bad. And there are more progressive approaches to understanding Islam's role in life. There's a diversity of experiences from Malaysia to Morocco to Jordan and so on. But I think the starting assumption should be, and really needs to be, that Islam is going to be there in one form or another. And if we kind of go into it saying that Islam has to be privatized or it has to be pushed into the private realm, that's not very productive because it's not realistic. And also that's conducive sometimes to authoritarianism and repression, because you have had secular modernizers in the Middle East who have said precisely this: we have to push Islam back so it's playing less of a role. And that's led to decades of repression in countries like Turkey and Tunisia and so on. So I think we have to challenge some of those assumptions. And I'll just close here to relate to you. And this captured it quite well for me. Some of you might remember this debate that happened in October 2014 on Real Time with Bill Maher, when the actor and director Ben Affleck got in this really charged debate with Bill Maher and the new atheist philosopher Sam Harris, who I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with. And I would recommend, when you have a chance, to look at this debate, because Ben Affleck got like really pissed off. And that was – so I think that Bill Maher said something like – or Sam Harris said – it was something like, Islam is the lodestar of bad ideas. They were saying problematic things about Islam. So Ben Affleck gets worked up and he says no, and he kind of pushes back. I think a lot of us as American Muslims were cheering Ben Affleck on because we're not used to people defending us on national television. Yay, someone likes us. Good. So so essentially Ben Affleck was saying, hey, Muslims are just like us too. They want to raise families and have good jobs. And he actually said this. He said, they also like eating sandwiches. And I thought this was interesting. And I can vouch for that Muslims do like eating sandwiches. But it's possible to like eating sandwiches and still support the implementation of Islamic law in some way in a Muslim-majority country. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. And so while I liked what Ben Affleck had to say, I felt that he was missing some of the nuance there. And that's, I think, you know, those of us on the liberal left, we want to always say that we're all the same. We all want the same thing. And I understand that. It's well-meaning and it's well-intentioned. But I think we also have to come to terms with the fact, and we're seeing it more and more with the rise of Trump, the far right in Europe and so on, is that we aren't all the same. But more importantly, I think the question we should ask ourselves is why do we have to be the same? So I'll end there and look forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Wow,
I was, and I guess I should also—I was also reminded to just remind you all that try to put your question in the form of a question, if that makes sense.
Wow, really interesting talk.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask a real quick question. You focused on the fact that the caliphate ending was sort of the catalyst for this, and I was curious your thoughts on, instead, having heard also, I've also heard about the idea of 19th century and sort of imperialism in the area for people like Sayyid Qutb in like kind of founding a lot of the ideology, that sort of the radical side of the Muslim Brotherhood. Yeah. Just wanted to hear your thoughts about how the 19th century as well sort of impacted the rise of sort of Islamic political philosophy.
Okay, so a 19th century. Who do you have in mind? From the
I was
19th
thinking like Sayyid Qutb. I think is one
okay,
of them.
He was in the a little bit later.
Oh, okay,
but, yeah, but yeah, I'll talk about Sayyid Qutb.
Yeah,
okay, you're right. Okay, so Qutb is a really interesting personality, and well, not to give you the whole history of his life, but essentially he was an Egyptian Islamist figure. He was he became one of the Muslim Brotherhood's ideologues in the 1950s. What's really interesting about Qutb is that he took a little trip to the U.S. in the late 1940s. He had a two-year kind of master's in education program in a teaching college in Greeley, Colorado. And what's interesting is that I don't want to blame Greeley, Colorado, but after he comes back from that trip, he gets a little bit more radical, and he kind of becomes more of an Islamist. He actually started out as a secular literary figure. He even wrote a novel or two. But he moves in this particular direction. He was very disillusioned by his experience in Colorado. Now, it, of course, was at a time when there was a lot of racism, and Sayyid Qutb was a little bit darker, so he felt some of that racism himself. He was also quite uncomfortable with what he considered to be inappropriate sexual mores, and he talks about this in some of his memoirs. There's actually a funny but also kind of like weird one where he talks about being in the ship as he was kind of going to the U.S. and he was in his ship room. I don't know what they call those, but yeah, ship room, I guess. And then apparently as he puts it, I think, half-naked woman comes and knocks on his door, and she asks him if he has some space in his room. And he didn't realize exactly what she was getting at right away, but then it hit him, and he was scandalized by this. So he talks about being scandalized by this kind of sexual aggressiveness of the Western woman. Anyway, he had some issues with all that, but he gets imprisoned in the 1950s, and he becomes more radicalized over time, and he sees brutality from the authoritarian regime of Gamal Abdel Nasser. And he sees people being killed in their cells, and he hears the screams of torture. And this has a big effect on him. So what Qutb asks himself is, how can my fellow Egyptian guards do such brutal things to their fellow Egyptians? So the way he kind of got around this is he said, well, maybe they're not true Muslims. And maybe Nasser, the autocrat, is not a true Muslim. And this kind of provided the foundation for what later became known as Takfiri ideology, this idea that someone who is nominally Muslim isn't necessarily Muslim because they've violated the core tenets of the faith, and therefore they are now outside the fold. And if they're outside the fold, then their blood becomes licit. So that's why many extremist groups today, including Al-Qaeda and to some extent ISIS and many others, they draw inspiration from some of the ideas that were essentially planted in the prisons of 1950s and 60s Egypt.
Yes. This is live, I guess. Could you explain, both in what you talked about in your lecture to us and your book itself, the full meaning of your subtitle?
Okay. Okay, so let me just say something about the title first. So we actually I was debating about the title until like the very last minute. And it was actually going to be called something else before. I'm like, I'm going to go for Islamic exceptionalism. I think it was the right choice. I don't want to tell you what the other title was. It wasn't actually that good. But what I really wanted to do was to make sure that the argument was right there in the title. And part of what I was torn about was I was worried that people would get the wrong idea just by looking at the title, and they would see exceptionalism and they might interpret that to mean that, oh, Islam is fundamentally different in a bad way, and oh, those Muslims are exceptional. So I was worried about how it might be taken. Then again, there was also the argument that people might see it as positive if you're looking at it from the standpoint of American exceptionalism. So I wasn't really sure how people would interpret the title, but I felt that I wanted to really own my argument, and I didn't want to soft pedal it. I didn't want to be afraid of my own conclusions. So I'm like, I'm going to put it in the title, and I'm going to make my case, and I'm not going to back down from that. And I'll try to make it in as nuanced a way as I possibly can. The subtitle, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. How the struggle over Islam is reshaping the world. I guess that is, we are seeing that struggle. We're seeing it in the Middle East. We're seeing it in South and Southeast Asia, where people are fighting over what Islam means to them. And it's not just now any longer in the Middle East. It's reshaping. Initially it was going to be reshaping the Middle East, but we changed it to the world because it's reshaping the West. Countries like France that have large Muslim minorities, this has become one of the key political debates. In our own country, Donald Trump apparently likes talking about us all the time. This has become a worldwide debate, and it's one that I think will consume us for decades to come. So I wanted to capture this idea that it's not just about the Middle East any longer. Now, I could have chose something like the battle for the soul of Islam. I didn't want to do something corny and cliche like that, the soul of Islam and all that. So that's kind of what I went for. Hope you like it.
I'm a little bit of a dilemma here. I can't tell from your remarks whether Islam is a political party or a religion or all of the above, possibly at times. Secondly, it appears that in your defining exceptionalism of Islam, that you have the white hats and black hats, the white hats being the Muslim Brotherhood and those people, the black hats being the Islamists, the Al-Qaedas, and so forth. And secondly, given the subtitle of your book, since we're a nation founded on religious freedom and separation of church and state, if the objectives are what apparently you outline in your book, I haven't read it, I've skimmed it, why would we want many Islamists to come to the United States to preach reshaping the world in their image?
Okay, so first of all, I would say that Islam is not a political party. So I guess this part of the problem is that when we use the word religion in the West, we're thinking about a particular category. Religion is something that can be clearly defined, and it's more about personal and private conscience, if you will. That's very much a post-Enlightenment phenomenon. Religion isn't necessarily just that. And I think this idea that you can separate between the sacred and the profane, that's not really how people live their religion, at least in the Middle East. Like I said, how do you know what's sacred and what's profane when everything is part of God's kingdom, if you will? So I think we have to problematize this idea that religion is something that you can kind of like put in a box, right? So in that sense, Islam is a religion, but it's a religion that has something to say about politics. That's sort of how I would say it. I would not say Islam is a political party or it has a specific political project, because if you ask 50 Muslims, what does Sharia mean to you? And Sharia doesn't mean just a bunch of scary punishments. Sharia really has to do with anything dealing with the practice of Muslims. So how you pray five times a day or how you fast in the holy month of Ramadan, all of that falls under Sharia, which just pretty much means, in a way, God's rules. That's not just about politics, but also private practice. So if you ask 50 Muslims, you know, what does Sharia mean, they'd all give you different answers. There is real diversity here. So in the U.S., we have separation of church and state, but we don't have separation of religion from politics. And I think that's one advantage that the U.S. has over, say, France, which has a much more aggressive secularism, which is about privatizing all religion. Keep it out of public life, keep it out of the state, so on and so forth. But here in the U.S., anyone who has strong religious convictions is allowed and even sometimes encouraged to express those in public life. That's what Christian evangelicals do. That's what Orthodox Jews do. And I think that's part of what makes America so great, is that it was a refuge for people who were persecuted for their own religion in Europe, and they were able to express it more openly here in the U.S. So I think that's an important distinction to make. So I think if Muslims are coming, are immigrating to the U.S., I don't think there's any real problem here, because they could be conservative, they could be quite practicing, and they want the Islam might inform how they view politics, right? But that's how Christian evangelicals approach it too. Now, because Muslims are only like 1% of the population, there's no real risk that Sharia is going to be implemented. There's a lot of, I think, fear-mongering on the right about creeping Sharia and all those things. But let's be honest, we're only 1% of the population. You don't need to, I mean, so...
There wasn't a problem in France several decades ago, but I now let's fast forward to today.
Okay. So here's the thing that I would say. I think that there's also aspects of Islamic law which make it very clear that you have to respect the law of the land in which you live. So even if you might like something different in your ideal world, if you become an American citizen, the mainstream scholarly opinion among Orthodox Muslim scholars, is that you have to respect the law of the land. And that, I think, so in France, for example, you might have, a French Muslim might have problematic views about, let's say they don't believe in gay rights or gay marriage, or they have illiberal ideas, they're not comfortable with the right to blaspheme, so on and so forth. I think liberal societies have to be able to accommodate illiberalism, as long as citizens are expressing that illiberalism through the legal democratic process. Anyone has the right to have objectionable views. There is actually nothing – that's a constitutional right. And if we really wanted to say that we got to push people out who have objectionable views, quite frankly, I'd be more scared of Trump supporters at this point, because I don't think Donald Trump respects our Constitution. I don't think he respects our Bill of Rights. So if we really wanted to apply that, I would say, hey, if there's a Trump supporter from Poland – there are, I'm sure, Trump supporters in Poland – if they wanted to immigrate, should we – allow them to immigrate into the U.S. considering that they have an ambivalent relationship to the constitutional protections of the Bill of Rights?
As long as they're not jihadists.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't think we should be letting jihadists in. I think we can all agree on that. Yeah,
okay,
for sure.
Okay.
We have to move on to the next question, but thank you. Yeah.
I wonder if part of your pessimism about the prospects of a sort of drift towards secularism in the Islamic world comes from the fact that you have a very strong sort of – there's a strong notion of secularism, and there is a progressively weaker notions of secularism, if you want to talk about strong, meaning that there has been an entire and complete divorce of church and state, religion and politics. And as you say, in the United States, there is actually nothing quite as extreme as the – sort of banishment of religion from the public discourse. One of the reasons for that, though, and I wonder the question I ask is whether you think this is a possibility in the Islamic world now or sometime soon, is because on the religious side, in particularly in American fundamentalism, there's been a long tradition of concern that excessive politicization of the religious community harms the religion.
Yeah.
That essentially it corrupts the church, whatever you conceive the church of, if the church itself is too involved in politics, because politics is sort of the profane world, and individual believers can, of course, be politically active, and their religious faith informs their activity, but there is no organized movement of church into the political arena. I mean, political fundamentalism of the sort of moral majority side is actually quite new, as the most radical Islamism.
Yeah.
So do you see that as a possibility in the Islamic world, a sort of a divorce of church and state based on protection of the religion.
Okay, so there is already a divorce of mosque and state in much of the Sunni majority world, because we don't have so I'm Sunni Muslim myself. We don't have a clergy. So there isn't really something called the church in the same way that you're talking about it, which is actually part of the problem, is because there's no centralized religious authority. So anyone can sort of become like a spur-of-the-moment preacher. And a lot of the radical Islamists, those preachers, a lot of them don't have actual credentials or scholarship. They just, you know, they're kind of doing their own thing. And that's why the democratization of Islamic thought and Islamic authority is good in some ways, because when things are more open to more people, that is good in theory. But there's also the dark side. It's led to a kind of intellectual chaos. But your point on the excessive politicization of religion is a real problem. And that's why it's interesting that today many mainstream Islamist movements are talking about separating the movement from the party. So, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt had the Muslim Brotherhood movement. They formed a political party called the Freedom and Justice Party, but everyone who was a Brotherhood member was only allowed to join the party. And this creates some problems, because if the party does really bad in politics, it reflects badly on the religious movement. So now there's some interesting debates, and Ennahda in Tunisia actually announced this a couple months ago, that they were separating their religious activities from their political activity. So I think there is so I wouldn't say it's so much the problem of politicization. The problem is more making religion the province of one political party, to make it a partisan vehicle. And that's why I think what would be more healthy generally is to not have just one Islamist party, but to have four or five, and people have the choice. And that's why I think Indonesia is a really interesting case, because you have a bunch of different Islamist parties. None of them are really dominant. They compete with each other. So, you know, wanting Islam to play a bigger role in public life is not just one party's thing. And what's interesting, too, is that you even have some ostensibly secular parties that also say they want Islam to play a central role in public life. Why? Because if secular parties want to win in conservative regions of Indonesia, they have to meet the median voter halfway. So if you want to win an election, you have to learn to speak the language of religion if people are quite conservative in that region.
You see in some countries that have a sizable Muslim minority, but where they aren't the majority, they're allowed to keep like certain separate civil codes for separate religious groups. Like the Muslim minority will have Sharia in its own community, and there's usually a lot of backlash to that. What do you think about that?
So in which societies would...
I think in India or in Israel or countries where there are a fair amount of Muslims and they have their own set of civil codes. And usually people get really mad when that happens. I'm just wondering, do you have thoughts on it?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, because... So Israel actually has, official Sharia courts for the Muslim minority. Interestingly enough, no one ever talks about. Can you imagine someone like on the right who like loves Israel and all that? Oh, Israel also has Sharia courts. Great. But I think that there should be. I think it's an interesting model that you let sort of individual communities have their own approach on certain issues having to do with family law, for example. I think the danger is making that mandated. So if you're a member of the Muslim minority in, say, India, that there's pressure on you to sort of go to a Sharia court, because you should have the choice to go to just a normal civil court where you, as a woman, for example, might have more rights and so on. So I think that there's a kind of a balance to be struck there. But I generally like the idea of devolving authority to local communities. I've been thinking more and more about kind of communitarian philosophy, because, you know, we have this crisis, I think, in this country on left and right, where there aren't really a lot of new ideas on the political theory standpoint. And I think one thing that we should be talking more about is how to empower local communities. And I think, too, that, you know, not to go – I'll do a very small digression here. that I feel like we live in a time in the West where there's unfettered individualism and liberal democracy is under threat. People are saying that liberal democracy isn't enough for them. They're looking for something beyond that. They're looking for meaning and belonging. And that's why we see the recourse to white nativism, ethno-nationalism, hyper-nationalism, xenophobia, populism in so many parts of the West. Here in the U.S., Poland is scary, Hungary is scary, France may get more scary, so on and so forth. So it seems to me that there is something missing, and we have to think about alternatives that can provide people with more meaning in their communities. That's a little digression, but anyway, yeah. Thank you.
So, Shani, we have about 5 minutes left and about six people online. So that's less than 1 minute per question.
Okay, I'll be quick.
Can you do that?
Maybe two or three at a time? Or
sure,
what do you think?
Yeah, let's try that.
Okay.
Well, firstly, thank you. I thought it was a really excellent book. So in your final chapter, you kind of tell the story of how we should move on, right?
You're not going to tell them what happens at the end, are you?
I'm not going to – no spoilers or anything like that. So part of that story is that after these revolutions actually occurred, that you should kind of incorporate these precautions into the constitutions, like liberal vetoes and stuff like that. I thought that was really interesting. What was kind of what I wanted to see a little bit more of, and I want to hear a little bit more of your opinion on, is how you think a mature liberal democracy like the U.S. should kind of engage Islamists at this point. Like, do you think that the differences are so irreconcilable that it's going to kind of lead to a policy of containment, kind of a la Kenan and NSD68 and kind of the Soviet Union? Or do you think there's enough there vis-a-vis their use of the state and vis-a-vis their kind of the liberal elements that they do incorporate? Do you think that liberal or kind of diplomatic inroads can be made, and what form those inroads should kind of take?
Great. Thanks. And I'll maybe just take one more and take them both. Yeah.
So you mentioned the difference between Christianity and Islam, how they evolved differently in the West and in the Middle East. So I was wondering how you think Islam should play a role in Middle Eastern governments, like what that should look like today.
Okay. So on the first question, I don't like this whole discourse of Islamism is the problem. So Islamism becomes the catch-all for everything that's bad in the Middle East. I think it's very important, especially now, to make very careful, nuanced distinctions between different kinds of Islamists. Within Islamism itself, there's a wide diversity of groups, as I said. So the fact that ISIS considers the Muslim Brotherhood to be apostates, that should tell us something, that we shouldn't lump them in the same basket, right? And if there are groups that accept the basic premise of the nation state, and there are groups that are totally against the basic premise of a nation state, that's a huge difference. So I think that policymakers have to be much more attuned to those differences. And if there are Islamist parties that are willing to work within the political process, respect the democratic rules of the game, renounce violence, so on and so forth, then we don't have to like them, but we should at least be willing to engage with them, just as we engage with secular and liberal groups. And I think that we've had this Islamist dilemma for a long time, that we as Americans, we like democracy in theory, we just don't like democracy in practice in terms of what it actually produces in the Middle East. So what happens when Islamist parties come to power through free and fair elections? Then we're in a bind, right? And this is why I think we didn't do more. We didn't do more to speak out against the coup in Egypt against a democratically elected Islamist government. Again, there were a lot of problems with that government, and we didn't have to like them. But coups against democratically elected leaders are not good. And I think we're seeing how the very dangerous direction Egypt is going in now. On the second question, what would it look like today? That's not really for me to say. I think that it's for the people in each individual country to make their own decisions. And it, like I said, it'll differ from country to country. But this is why I think democracy is so important, because I think it's up to voters to vote whichever party they think is best. They can vote for an Islamist party, a Salafi party, a socialist one, a secular one, whatever. And then there will be a kind of democratic give and take. It'll be messy. It's not going to be easy. There are going to be real contentious fights over the drafting of new constitutions. Constitutions are hard because that's the founding document of a new polity, right? And what is the role of religion going to be in a new constitution? That was a big problem that Egypt had in 2011 and 2012. But I think that's why it's so important that the democratic process has to play out, Because if you abort it just a couple years in, then part of the problem is it's never really been tried. We don't actually have examples of Islamist parties coming to power through democratic elections and then staying for a long enough period of time. There's only one case that in the Middle East that we currently have, which is the AK Party in Turkey, which is like its own discussion, as there was a coup attempt the other week. That's the thing about the Middle East. Like, you could actually – I remember I went off Twitter for a couple hours and then I go back on and I'm just like, what? There's a coup in Turkey and no one saw that coming. So that's a scary thing. Whenever you go on Twitter, you expect something very bad to happen. So I guess do we have time for one last one? Can you take these next three real fast? Yeah, let's take them very quickly and I'll answer them all or try to.
Hi, thank you for your talk. And you talked about sort of two alternatives, or these two alternatives came up in the talk. One is sort of the secular state, totally secular, that kind of view. Another is the, in a Muslim majority state, a more illiberal type of set of rules for everyone. But I wonder, wouldn't even within and from Islam itself there be a third sort of in between liberal democracy, liberal state type of option, you know, focus arguing from the nature of God, similarly to from, you know, an argument from the nature of God in Christianity, the idea that God is merciful and he, and the idea that there is no coercion in religion. So the idea that there would have to be freedom given to all minorities within a state. So it would be something, a majority Muslim state that would be make room for those minorities. I wonder what would sort of enable that or what would prevent that development. And if you see the Marrakesh Declaration from earlier this year as something sort of along those lines.
Okay, thanks. Great.
Thank you very much. You talked about the tension between the modern nation state and Islam. And I recently read Al-Halak's book, The Impossible State.
Yeah.
And I was very upset because his vision of the modern nation state is one that's immoral or lacking morality. And he cites Nietzsche and he cites Carl Schmitt, who's generally considered the theoretician of Nazism. And so I'm wondering to what degree his vision of the modern nation state as a something that's not very appealing and certainly not a liberal democracy has resonated.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your talk. You were mentioning sort of earlier how the beginning of Islam, how it was founded, governing initially and being involved in politics from the very beginning, sort of influenced how politics is in Islam now. I was wondering what you thought about groups like the Salafi Quietists and their ilk, who believe very strongly. They consider themselves, you know, going back to the fundamentals, but explicitly reject involvement in politics. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so first question, is there a third option, making room for minorities and so on? I hope that third option will present itself at some point in our lifetimes. Again, I would cite Indonesia as I don't use the word model anymore because I don't want to jinx anything. Because remember, we used to call the Turkish model and then we saw how that went, so I'm not going to use that word. So how about template? Indonesia provides an interesting template in that Islam does play a role in public life, and it's somewhat normalized in certain local regions. There is actually implementation of Sharia bylaws and ordinances and so on. And there is still, equality for minorities protected by the federal constitution. There are tensions, and it hasn't worked perfectly. But that's why you have to let it play out. And Indonesia is a work in progress. But Islamist movements, the mainstream ones that I've talked about, have gotten better on some of these issues. So in Nahda and Tunisia, which are like the most gentle, fluffy Islamists that you can find. You don't know how long that's going to last and how much of that is to kind of – they want to present an image of moderation for the international community. They want to play it safe and so on. Anyway, they have said positive things about respecting minority rights and so on. Now, the question is how do you actually make sure that that happens in practice? And this is where I think drafting good constitutions matters. You need to have constitutions that protect some minimal level of basic rights. And what's encouraging about Tunisia is they have a relatively liberal constitution, which hopefully will contribute to that. On the modern nation state, okay, I've become a little bit disillusioned with the nation state, to be honest with all of you. I don't think that there's a great alternative. So I think this is – we got to work with what we have. We have the Westphalian order. I think getting rid of borders would actually lead to more bloodshed, not less. You'll create a new set of problems. But I think we have to rethink the dominance of the nation state. I feel nation states, especially in the Middle East, including in Turkey and Egypt, are so powerful, so centralized, so bloated, so overbearing that it makes politics that much more existential because everyone wants control of the dominant state structure. If the state was weaker, then presumably politics would be somewhat less existential. So this is why I think, you know, I talk a little bit about decentralization, de-evolution of powers, empowering local communities, budget autonomy on the local level. We have to think about more creative models so that power is redistributed throughout society. And then lastly, on the Salafi quietists, okay. Well, there are these, let's say, Salafi quietists who kind of take a step back from politics, that kind of do their own thing, a lot of preaching and religious education. They don't really confront the ruling authorities, even if they're secular. And they kind of draw on this strain of Islamic law where even if a ruler is bad, as long as he's nominally Muslim, you don't fight the ruler. So there's it's a quietist approach to politics. But even that's political. So is anything really ever apolitical? I mean, because if your position is that you don't want to confront the ruling autocratic authorities, that is a political position. You are making a political choice not to speak out against repression or injustice. So the problem is everything. So everything – you can't – it's very hard to be neutral in the Middle East today. It's, at some level, you have to take a side. The hope is that the different people who take sides will agree to disagree with each other through a peaceful democratic process. So I'm under no illusions that people will stop hating each other because people hate each other for legitimate reasons. If you have a fundamentally different view of the state than your fellow countrymen, and we're having some of that here in the U.S. today, then we have to accept difference. We're going to disagree profoundly. But the goal, and maybe it's a modest goal, is that we agree to respect each other's differences. And at least in the Middle East, that people should agree not to kill each other over those differences. I guess that's as optimistic as a note as I can end on.
So it's
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.